How's everybody doing?
All right, welcome everyone. This is another opportunity for us to get together and have our coaching call for this week. And what a great set of questions we had come in about our last week's coaching call. Many of you might remember that in our last week's call, we had some discussions about how we form habits and some of the toxic ways that we behave that are basically habits, sometimes cultural habits, sometimes even familial habits. But before we get started into our normal routine here for our coaching call, we want to go back and have a chat just for a little bit, about what our coaching call is here to accomplish. Remember, this is a friends and family call, right? If you want to know more about how you can advance in a career in coaching, which hopefully this will be a great introduction to a coaching career, if you want to figure out how that's done, talk to the person who contacted you, and they can help you to opt in for our weekly clarity reports and get the specifics for the call next week and how you might be able to go on to become a certified professional coach, a member of the International Coaching Federation, and part of the team, really, of health, of building health here in our communities, in our families, and even in our species anywhere in the world. That's really what coaching is about. But it's easier sometimes to define coaching by what it is not rather than by what it is. So let's take a moment and we'll decide what coaching is not. Coaching is not expert advice. Now, there are times when we need expert advice, and all of us know various ways that we could get it. You know, ask somebody smarter than us, go to the library, Google it. There are a lot of different ways that we can gain expert advice, and that is wonderful when it's needed, but that's not coaching. A coach is not a teacher. It's not a consultant, and it's not a surrogate parent. A coach is a person who, by their very nature and definition of their job, is to become invisible. A coach eventually wants to take themselves completely out of the equation. So that leads us to what coaching actually is. Coaching is a voice of clarity. A coach focuses on the message rather than the messenger, right? As I said earlier, take yourself out of the equation. Don't be responsible. There are three C's in coaching. We say, we didn't cause this problem, and we can't correct this problem, but we care. That's that third C. We care enough to show you other options, perhaps ask you questions, perhaps illustrate through this voice of clarity a message that you can be the master in your domain. You can be the PhD in your life. And that's very liberating when you're no longer responsible, right? I didn't cause it, I can't correct it, but I care enough to help you find clarity in your own life. Take yourself out of the equation. Again, that'll take a huge rock off your shoulders. A coach does one thing in particular. He asks questions and then he listens for the answers. And the question that we ask most commonly is, what do you want? What do you want? The 10 questions we say, what do you want? What are your strengths? What are your challenges? We ask again and again, what do you want? What should you do to get there? What will you do to get there? When will it be done? You're rating your overall level of commitment and then doing some things to escalate that level of commitment. We co-design accountability and then we take action. And of course, action sparks a new cycle of coaching. As we've used in our illustration a number of times, coaching is really about being on a journey of 1,000 miles, and everyone is on that same journey. To switch illustrations very quickly, to switch metaphors to the Wizard of Oz, we say all of us are going to Emerald City, you know, but we have to have the heart for it, the brains for it, and the courage to take that next step. But back to our Chinese illustration, the journey of 1,000 miles begins underneath your feet, right, with that first step. Every time you take a step, it changes your perspective. And that changed perspective makes us ask the question once again, now what do you want? And then, of course, once a person's taken a step or two in that direction, they gain greater clarity, they gain greater insight and new perspective, and we go back and ask again, what do you want? And we keep asking that question. And then we ask, what's important about that, about what it is you want. And we ask people to make a list, and we ourselves have our own list. We make a list of everything, whether it seems like it's important or doesn't matter at all. We make a list, and then we go back, and we, in time, right after we've had a time to think it through, to meditate on it, to talk to others, after we've taken a nap, after we've had a good meal, right? Nothing looks better than it does after a good meal and a good night's sleep. And then we go back and ask ourselves again, what do we want? And what do we put in our A column, our B column, and our C column, right? C's are things that you want, and you want them very much. B's are things that you want, and you want them very, very much. A's are the things that you want the most. You want them very, very, very much. And now we start to ask the why. Now, why is too big of a question for early on in the conversation? We just ask what's important about that. I want a red Ferrari. Really, what's important about a red Ferrari? What's important about red? What's important about Ferrari? What's important about a car? What is this going to do for you? How will you be different once you have it? How will your life change? What's important about that life change? And then you make that list. And then at a point, once we've solidified our list, we can start to go into the why. Why we want something is extraordinarily important, but we never begin there because it's just too big of a question. Once we have that idea, what do we want and what's important about it, we start talking about our strengths that we're going to use to help us get there. What we bring into the room when we walk in, how does the room change? How do we change the dynamic by inserting ourselves, by our very presence? How do we make this world a better place? Who are we at our best? And also, what are our challenges? We might say our weaknesses. We might even say our flaws. But that's not politically correct to say that, so we only say challenges. So who are we at our worst? It's good for us to know that. What are the gremlins that are constantly sabotaging our pathway to success? What are those voice of inner counsel of critics, that jury that's always judging you? What do they say? And what can you take away that you can have as a strength? And when do you need to tell these guys to go back to their jury box and just leave you alone for a little while so that you can move forward with all of your strengths toward the things that you really, really, really want? And see, with these things in mind, we already are starting to gain some clarity. Remember, we also talked about the things that we know about ourselves and the things that we don't know. In fact, we divided these known elements of our own personality, our strengths and our weaknesses, our strengths and our challenge. We decided we're going to move those into four boxes. The things that we know about ourselves that we don't share with anyone. The things that others know about us and that we know about ourselves. The things that others know about us, but we're blind to them, right? We haven't learned what those are just yet. And then finally, there is that mystery box. There are things that are inside of us, good and bad, that we just never have known we were capable of. Right? They're a mystery to us and a mystery to others. And sometimes we do something that we even surprise ourselves. We surprise the people around us, and we just say, I don't know why I did that. I don't know. And that's actually the most honest response imaginable. I just don't know. But those are the elements about our strengths and our weaknesses that we need to come to grips with. We need to get a grasp of that if we're going to have the proper tools to help us move forward. Now we've defined what we wanted, we've defined what was important about it. When we get down to the biggest, most significant part of the things we want on our A list, we ask why we want that. And then we talk about an analysis of our strengths and our weaknesses. We bring in the people that we love to help us define these things best. P.S. Don't ask your enemies about your weaknesses and your strengths. Don't even discuss with them your sense of purpose. Right, there's always a loss of dignity when you talk with people who don't have your best interests in mind. Right, life's too short to hang around with jerks. You can quote me on that. Certainly my daughter does. The idea is that there are people that love you, that want the very best for you, that can help you see yourself as you can't see from the inside. So talk to them and be honest with them and tell them this is part of your coaching education to help you get to where you really, really want to be. And so what should you do to get there? We're going to have a chat about that later this evening, because we're going to talk about SMART goals. What should we do to get there, and what will we do to get there? Those are two separate and yet important questions. And it deals with the concept of integrity, because the things that we say we should do are the things we should be doing. Isn't that true? The things that we preach are the things that we should be practicing. That's true. And yet, of course, no one's perfect, but we are all moving in the direction of integrity, where our thoughts, our words, and our actions are all in harmony with one another. And then, again, with our SMART goals, when will it be done? And if you're going to be a true leader, you're going to have other people with you on the journey. So by whom will it be done? By you or by someone you assign or delegate to? Look at your overall level of commitment. If it's a very large task, you're going to need a significant level of commitment in order to marshal the energy you'll need to accomplish a large goal. Rate your overall level of commitment and know the bigger the goal, the higher the level of commitment, the higher it has to be. You can't climb Mount Everest with a commitment level of 1 on a scale of 0 to 10, right? You just simply must have a much deeper level of commitment for such a monumental task. So look at the size of the task and rate the level of commitment and take the steps that are necessary to escalate that level of commitment. The bigger the task, the higher the level of commitment, the longer period of time you're going to have to sustain it, the more difficult it will be, but it will be worth it. So let's do what we need to do right now to escalate that level of commitment. We'll co-design accountability with the people around us. Now, as a coach, you're going to be talking with your client about co-designing a level of commitment of accountability with you. We will agree to an assignment of tasks. And because we know that humans thrive on that reward and penalty cycle of learning, that's how we create a new habit, reward and penalty, not just reward and not just penalty, right? Reward and penalty in balance will help us to create a new habit. That's part of accountability. And then the moment we take action, then it's time for us to talk about that, right? How did that change our perspective, taking that one step? How did that change what we want? Does our list look the same? And we're going to develop what we call, get ready for this. This is something you may need to write down. I prefer if you just go ahead and get a tattoo about this moment of clarity. But when you get to this point of taking a step and looking at how you feel, we call this moment passive curiosity. Passive because you're not really judging it. It simply is. And you can always trust what is. So let's take a look at this with some intellectual honesty and say, in a passively curious way, that's very interesting. I did this. It had this effect, and this is how it made me feel, or this is how it changed my perspective, or this is what those around me had to do in order to adapt or to change to this, right? But rather than judging that, saying, man, I better not do that anymore, or I should do more of that, or whatever it is, we're just going to say we're passively curious about it. That's very interesting. And we're going to journal our interest, but we're not going to judge that interest. Still, it's necessary and important to be curious. Life is really about what's over that next mountain or what's beyond that next hill or on the other side of the fence, or what perspective is going to change when we take that next step. Curiosity is quintessential to life. We simply cannot grow without a state of curiosity. There are other things that are important to life as well. One of them is enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is quintessential to life. Here's why. The word theos is a Greek word, and it means God. And the word theos in theos means God within or God upon, God breathed, for example. And so we say when we are those who believe that humans are created in the image of God, that when we have enthusiasm, that is our natural state. That's when we're living life exactly as we were designed to live life, in theos. With God's power and breath upon us, the enthusiasm inside of us, the vision ahead of us, in theos, right? So enthusiasm becomes necessary for us. Now, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about spirituality. In spirituality, we have to look at the nature of humans, right? We are inherently a spiritual creature. We have appreciation for art, for music, for laughter and love. And those aren't tangibles. Those are spiritual qualities. And so as we look at our own future, we recognize the things that in us create enthusiasm, right? When we find those areas of passion, of joy, of enthusiasm in Theos, right, that is the moment we are kissed by the muse. We need to do a lot more of that. And we need to do a lot less of the things that are sucking the marrow out of our bones. So kind of an idea of how we approach our coaching questions. Now, we've gone over those coaching questions with every call, and we'll continue to go over those coaching questions with every call. Why? Because this is a journey of 1,000 miles, and every step we take is going to give us a new perspective, and we'll be able to see the things right in front of us and the things right behind us. Now, a moment ago, I mentioned that we had some questions from folks this last week that came to us in our email. It was wonderful. Thank you so very much. But they all really boiled down into two different families of questions, all around something that we talked about on our previous call, where we mentioned that there is a habit that some people have where they absolutely must learn to be ill, learn to be injured, learn to in some way become a center of attention through tragedy. And that perpetual, constant culture of victimhood. And so we got two questions on that, really, basically. We got a lot of questions, but they boiled down to just two. And the two questions were, why in the world would we talk about something like that on a coaching call? And the other one was, can you talk a little bit more about that on the next coaching call? So we're going to do the second one. We're going to talk a little bit more about our habits, because it's very important for us as we learn the stages of change in human behavior. It's very important for us to learn that these important habits. That way we can examine our own stages of change and know when we're entering in one of these self-defeating moments, one of these times when we self-sabotage. So we were talking about perfectionism. And perfectionism, remember, is punishment is there in perfectionism. It may not be corporal punishment. It might be just a timeout or a disapproving look. But approval is always lacking in perfectionism. And we liken that to the carrot and the stick. You know, the old story about the carrot and the stick was not feed him the carrot and hit him with a stick, although that's kind of what it's morphed to mean. It was really about getting the focus and attention of an animal, a draft animal, by putting a carrot at the end of a long stick and hanging it out in front of the draft animal. And so they would be walking toward that carrot thinking that they were going to get something to eat. But of course, they never got to the carrot, right? You can never get there. No matter what you do, it's always just out of reach. This is the way it is with approval in a perfectionistic model. Approval is always just out of reach, right? So success is always just out of reach. And we begin to strive, and we continually strive, and we make a habit out of striving, and after a while, we don't even know what we're striving for. We've lost sight of the potential for that reward. It's the reason why there must be a reward and penalty if we're going to sustain a behavior. Otherwise, the behavior will simply become extinct, meaning we'll lose that the power of that reward and penalty cycle. And now we just basically are striving out of habit without any particular focus or any particular sense of accomplishment. That's the variant of perfectionism that we live in our culture. We bathe in it, we breathe it, and we need to, and I mean everyone who listens to this needs to take steps to stop that and to stop that in our own environment. We will make the world a better place if we will stop the perfectionism and recognize the power of the reward penalty part of learning theory. So as we begin to talk about toxic levels of expectation on the call, one of the things that we came up with is how common this pathogenic attitude really is. It really is in our culture that we have this level of perfectionism, A subset of perfectionism is called benign neglect. Now, in this model, in benign neglect, basically there's no real reward for good behavior. There's no real penalty for bad behavior. It's not a rejection of the individual, but it's basically a neglect of this, of the power of this reward and penalty cycle. Extraordinarily powerful. It's how humans learn. We need to endorse it. If we don't, we become pathogenic, meaning that we're creating belief systems that are not going to serve the people in the future. So what we see in benign neglect is that there's something in the family that's usually creating a problem that needs attention right now, more attention than you. I don't have time to celebrate your victories. I don't have time to chastise your failures. You see, I am otherwise engaged. Now, it may be that you're engaged with something very important. We see this very commonly in the households where someone has, for example, a problem with addiction. We see it also in families where an individual in the household is very ill, whether it's a sibling or a parent. We see this also when there's difficulties in a family, such as divorce, imprisonment, families that are separated for long periods of time because of work or other circumstances. Basically, there is a neglect of the individuals at the moment they're creating a habit. And if we follow Eric Erickson's belief, we go through stages where we're at various ages, we accumulate various habits. And this benign neglect says that when it's time to pat you on the head and reinforce that habit, we're just simply not there. But we're otherwise engaged. But when we get sick, when we get injured, all of a sudden the whole world stops and the spotlight shines on us. See, we couldn't get attention from those around us any other way, but by choice or by chance, we might become injured or ill. And the next thing you know, we have all the attention in the world, all the attention we could possibly want. And I like to tell a little story, and this is a story about myself, because I've learned over the years, if you're talking about yourself, you're usually pretty safe. But the moment you start telling a story about somebody else, oh no, you're in trouble now. And heaven forbid, listen, if you're in public speaking, I'm going to share this moment of wisdom with you. Heaven forbid you tell a story about an animal. Because telling stories about an animal is always going to get you into trouble. As W.C. Fields used to say, never share the stage with children or animals because they're going to steal the scene and you're always going to be on the short end of that stick with the carrot. So I like to tell this story about a time when I was in Japan. And I happened to be walking around the city of Tokyo. I got my picture taken with Miss Tokyo, and that year, I think it was 1991, there was a tie for Miss Tokyo, so there were two Miss Tokyos. How lucky can a guy get? And I got my picture taken with both Miss Tokyos. Oh, my goodness. When I finally got back to the school, I had a sniffle, because it had been, you know, drizzling and cold and rainy all day. It didn't stop me. It was my only day in Tokyo. I wasn't going to miss it. I got back. And I had a sniffle. And several students heard me over there sniffling in the corner. That's something that an American would absolutely pay no attention to, and I didn't even notice it myself. And they came up to me and they said, Minshu Kyodai, which means Minshu my brother, and you're sick. And I said, no, I'm not sick. Come on, it's nothing. Yeah, you guys can't, you guys need to toughen up if you can't take something like this. Oh, no, we're going to treat you, right? So they did what all good Japanese people do. They put me in a hot bath, and I soaked in that hot bath, and I drank a chrysanthemum tea that was just out of this world delicious. They wrapped me up in a futon and gave me a massage until I fell asleep. And as I was drifting off, I was thinking, if I lived here, I know I could get a cold at least once a month. And that's exactly the kind of reward and reinforcement that can become quite addicting. It can become a habit then to do things to make you to make yourself sick or to get injured, or sometimes even just to, in the extreme cases, to just look like you're sick. But with now 35 years in clinical practice, I can tell you, when somebody says they're sick, they are sick. Now, maybe that's a sickness that we can define, and maybe it's one that's simply a habitual sickness. The key is, that's an individual who simply must go back to that well every time that they're feeling abandoned, every time they're feeling alone, every time they're feeling as if they don't matter. Yeah, you remember that. We will die if we don't matter. In fact, the entire lesson of love, why children, why old people, why a single people die without love is because they don't matter. The message, the lesson of love, the lesson of community, the lesson of belonging, right? And we all want to belong, whether it's to a gang or to a group or to a club or to a family. We all have a yearning to belong. And that yearning says what? It says we matter. We will die if we don't matter. So if an individual at a critical moment in their life came down with a cold and got a cup of hot tea and a good massage and lots of attention, they'll have a tendency to repeat that behavior. They will be the ones who will always be ill. They'll always have something wrong with them, and they will never be able to get well because the moment they're healthy, they don't matter anymore. And so you see them going from one illness to another, it lasts for days, weeks, months, years, decades, it can last an entire lifetime, and it's simply a habit. And remember, it's not something they're doing on purpose, it's something that you can actually discover right very quickly by saying, tell me, when you were young, when did the world stop and the spotlight shone on you? There will be some people who say, one year I got straight A's, this is my first time, and it was like they made a real big deal of it. Another will say, I excelled in some sport or some academic, or I accomplished some goal that we had set out. And that's when the whole world stopped and the spotlight was on me. But of course, the people that we're going to be listening for are the ones who say, you know, the only time that the world ever stopped and the spotlight shined on me was when I was sick. And that's when you say, look, this is why it's important for us to understand these habits, because now we know, right? Now we know. Let's take a look at this. This is what made you matter. We will die if we don't matter. These habits can last a lifetime unless we challenge them. The toxic expectation is perpetuated by the victim-rescuer model in families and in communities, and guess what? In my profession as well, in medicine. Right, we wait for somebody to get sick, then they come to us, and we rescue them, and we're the hero. Right, so the relationship that we have is always a relationship based on disparity and on need. So, and neediness. So there you go. We fit into that whole same model ourselves. On the other hand, breaking a bad habit will never be successful if the habit was forged as a facet of acceptance. Establishing a new habit will never be successful, get ready, unless it's rewarded and reinforced, right? Rewarded and reinforced. Lots of carrots, yes, lots of stick, but the new habit, it has to make us matter, and it has to make us matter to the people who matter to us. So I know some wanted us need to discuss that at length. Hopefully this has satisfied you. For those who didn't like it, hopefully you will forgive me and accept my apologies. The reason that it's important is so that we can spot these habits as something that can sabotage our ability to succeed with ourselves, with our families, with our coaching clients. We also talked about SMART goals. SMART goals are really around helping us to gain some clarity about what we're going to do and when we're going to do it, and perhaps some idea about who can help us accomplish the things that we need to accomplish. Developing SMART goals are key. They're critical to managing our own time and to managing the outcome of our own life. To be participants in our own life, we should be writing SMART goals. So when we come up with our ABC list, we're going to pick out an A, and we're going to pick out a B and a C, and we're going to establish some SMART goals around each one of those. A reason why we might decide to pick a B or a C is sometimes they're small, and small wins can help us gain the confidence that we need for larger wins, right, for larger successes. I'm always fascinated by the use of the English language when we talk about certain things. One of them has to do with self-esteem. There's a phrase that we use, self-esteem, when we mean something totally different, which is self-deprecation. You know, when a person talks badly about themselves, when a person has negative feelings about themselves, that's more self-deprecation than it is a loss or a lack of self-esteem. If we were to actually look at the definition of esteem or regard in the context of self-esteem, what we recognize is that an element of this, just a part of it, is being able to predict our own abilities, the opportunity that we have to carry out a goal and to see it to completion, and then to celebrate that completion. Right. So let's say that again. True esteem, self-esteem in this context, has to do more with our ability to predict success and then to carry out that goal, that accomplishment, that process. And when we're done, by the way, to be able to pat ourselves on the back and say, awesome job. Let's go on to do something even bigger next time. See, when we think of self-deprecation, that's, you know, I hate myself, I'm a horrible person, nobody loves me, I think I'll eat worms and die. So that's more of a self-deprecating spirit. It's an illness. As coaches, certainly we don't really engage that. There are healthcare professionals, friends, and family that can help us engage some solutions for that. But for us, when we hear someone say, I don't know that I can do this, I don't think that I can, that's true loss of self-esteem. So sometimes to gain that esteem, to gain that predictability, to be able to say, I know I can do this because I did that, we need to start off with a small goal. So let's just do one single small goal, maybe two, maybe three. But the key is we're going to do something small to build our confidence in doing something big. Now, in building a fire, you start with very, very tiny pieces of kindling, and then you have little larger twigs and little larger sticks, and then pretty soon you can put a tree trunk into a fire and keep it going, right? Because the fire is big enough. In building up towards accomplishing our goals, it's the same thing. We start off with something really small, and that leads us to understanding we can do something slightly larger, and slightly larger yet, and then finally something monumental. Something classic, something for the ages, something you were born to do, right? Put that log on the fire. You've got the confidence you'll be able to burn it. For us, we may need to start off with something small, especially if we grew up in one of the pathogenic attitudes that we've described in the last few coaching calls. We may need to start off with something small to gain a level of self-esteem, that is, to gain a level of predictability in our skills. What are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? They're well-defined, they're predictable, and now let's move forward with our SMART goals about something that we want, something we really want, something we really, really, really want. So the first part of the SMART goal, and we call them SMART goals because that's an acronym, S-M-A-R-T. The S in SMART stands for specific. Goals must be specific, and we need to write them out. Write them out in more and more simplistic terms, right? Simplify them and clearly define them. This is what needs to be done step by step by step. And then we continue to move forward with that specificity by saying this has to be M, measurable, SMART. It's S-M, measurable. They should be measurable so you can have tangible evidence that you've accomplished the goal, right? How do you know where you're going to go if you don't have a goal? How do you know when you've arrived if you don't have a clearly defined goal? So the goal statement part of a project can be very, very brief, but you basically say, here is specificity, and here's how I'm going to measure success. And then finally, we should be thinking about something that's A, achievable. You want something that's going to challenge you, something that is going to be a reach or a stretch for you, something that's going to make you a richer person. You know, whether it's climbing Mount Everest or it's something that is very small and personal and known only to you, learning to sing or play the guitar or learning another language, it should be something achievable. Now, if I said I wanted to be the first man on the moon, that's not really achievable because that's already been done. So that wouldn't be a good example of a SMART goal. But if I said that I wanted to learn a new song on the piano, that would be an achievable goal for me. And you have a good idea of what would be achievable goals for you. If you're having some difficulty with a bigger one, start with a smaller one. So again, specificity. That's the biggest part of the page so far. And then measurable. Our goals should be, there should be some metric that we can use. Achievable. That can sometimes just be a yes or no. Can I do it or not do it? Well, this might be a time for us to go back, talk with our friends and family, and find out if they think you can do it. But remember, only talk to the people you love. You don't need anybody taking pot shots at your goals. Finally, next time, I want to get to the end so bad. Next to our SMART goals are the results, right? We want to make sure that that our results now are something that are appreciable and contribute to the direction that we're going, contribute toward our overall life, to our overall vision, our purpose, our mission in life, right? So results focus, they are results, not activities. And then finally, they should be timely. That's the end. A time, S-M-A-R-T. The T is that they should be timely. Now, sometimes our time frames give us a sense of urgency. That means, for example, if I said I wanted to have something done, I wanted to pay my rent by the first of the month, the second of the month there would be people knocking on my doors. So they're timely. And we're going to make sure that our sense of urgency is intact and in place and is really realistic for this goal. Sometimes they are not, they don't require a sense of urgency, right? There's no dynamic tension between where we are and where we want to go. But the key for that kind of a goal is that without a sense of urgency, there's really no reason to take action. Coaching is about action. So we want to select the timely goals. You know, if somebody says, I want to get to the end of my life and realize that I've lived a good life and contributed to humanity, a goal that's set for the end of your life is not necessarily as urgent as a goal that you plan to accomplish by tomorrow or by next week, unless, of course, you know something about your lifespan that the rest of us don't know. The concept of choosing a SMART goal is to make sure that there is that dynamic tension between where you are, your current reality, and where you want to be, your vision of that goal, right? What do you want? A want implies that it's something you don't have, right? We always use that matrix. What do we have? What do we need, right? And under the heading of what do we have, what do we need, we say, what do we want? And what's the sense of urgency around that? So we write out our SMART goals, and we recognize that although 100% of the people in that one famous Harvard study, 100% of the people got the admonition to write out their goals, only 8% of them actually did. 20 years later, only 2% of them were still writing out their goals, and they were the most financially successful of the entire group. So we need to remember, if we want to be successful by any metric that we choose to measure, we need to be writing out our goals, and we need to be making our SMART goals, right? That's very, very important for us. But as we mentioned earlier, there are some things that can stand in our way. One of them is the habits of learning that we have. And I very much appreciated the anatomy of action, the anatomy of change that a Dr. Prochaska from University of Rhode Island put into a paper. And he called this the stages of change. That was just fascinating to me, to understand that that we do go through a process, and there is a time when we're really ready to change. Now, having said that, I'm going to pause for a moment and tell you the absolute number one most important part of any change has to do with maintenance of that change. Just like a good habit will go extinct if it's not reinforced, all habits will go extinct if there is no maintenance on them. So we need to maintain those habits, in my estimation, of the five stages of change, the most important is maintenance. Otherwise, there's an awful lot of activity, but there's really no accomplishment. So when you set down to write out your goals, you write out a new state where you want to be in the days, weeks, months, years, decades ahead, you're moving in that direction. The first thing that I recommend you consider is, how do I maintain that state once I get there? I recall an individual, he was a pop music star. You would know the name if I said it, so I'm not going to say it. And he said once upon a time, he said, I worked so hard to get here. And he said, but from the moment I started down this road, I had one idea. I don't want to just get there. I want to stay. Yeah, that was his goal. I want to stay as a pop music star. And of course, he's done things that really didn't go along with that goal. But by and large, we would all know his name. So this is a key for us, is as we're beginning a journey, we don't want to just get where we're going, but we want to be able to sustain and maintain that. So from my perspective, maintenance of the new state of being is the most important thing, and we should start with that before you even take that first step. Now, the stages of change, according to Prashaska, started off with a state that he called a pre-contemplation stage. In a pre-contemplation stage, he says, it's not just that we can't see the solution to the problem, but we can't even see the problem. We have what we call a very vague definition that something is wrong, right? We can just feel it. We feel that there's something missing. And in that something missing, we find ourselves looking, not necessarily for a solution, but for the problem, to define the problem. That's the pre-contemplation stage of change. Now, the problem, of course, is all around us. And if we ever want a definition of what's wrong with us, we should ask our family. And they will be happy to tell us what's wrong with us. But sometimes that isn't really the wisest course. Sometimes it's the wiser course to look at the discomfort as a messenger, right, as a friend who's trying to deliver some counsel that you desperately need. So we're going to say, in the pre-contemplation stage, you know that something is wrong. You have a vague sense that nature is somehow playing a cruel trick on you, and that you don't know what it is, you don't know what the problem is, and therefore there's no way for you to even begin to see the solution. Remember, that sense of unease, right, of uneasiness is your friend. It's a gift, and we should take time to attend to that and to decide what it is that it's trying to teach us. Now, the second stage in Prashaska's model is the contemplation stage. Pre-contemplation means I don't really know what's wrong. I just have this vague sense that something is wrong. And I got to tell you, the truest definition of stress is change. So we don't want to change because it's stressful. So it takes us a while to be able to define that problem. And once we do define it, then we can start looking at ways to solve it. But until then, we're going to have a sense of despondency, a vague sense of dissatisfaction. We may feel hopeless. And when that happens, then we know when we feel that way, it's a friend of ours. It's a messenger who's come to give us some kind but firm counsel, and we need to listen, and we need to move on to the next stage, which is identification of the issue, the concern, or the problem. So we get into stage number two, the contemplation stage. In contemplation, an individual is beginning to acknowledge the problem, to define the problem, to think about the problem, even to talk about the problem, but they are in no way at a moment where they're ready to solve the problem. Now, this is a point where sometimes well-meaning friends and family will come along and help a person by offering a solution. Wrong, wrong, wrong. I read an interesting article about a person who was at work was known as a problem solver. But when he got home, if he tried to apply those same tactics to solving problems at home, he was a big failure, a huge failure, because what the family needed was tea and sympathy. Listen, if somebody's got a problem, even if we can clearly see their problem, it's not likely that they can. If they can, they may not be ready to change. They may be stuck in contemplation, where they're defining it again and again and again in a circular fashion. Maybe what they need at that moment is tea and sympathy, right? Listen to them. Listen to them some more. Listen to them some more. And eventually, they will get to the place where they are ready to make that change. When that's so, what they're usually looking at is anticipation of that new state, right? I no longer want to be in this place where I'm stuck, where I'm feeling hopeless, where I'm feeling helpless and powerless. And I anticipate being in a better state. And now we start to ask, what's important about that? Because they'll tell you. They'll tell you, this is what my life is going to be like. This is how things will be different when I make this change, when I accomplish this goal. We're in that anticipation stage, and that's the moment of power. See, this is where the power comes from. No one can empower anyone else in the sense of giving them power. We just simply don't have enough power to spare. But when an individual gets to that place of anticipation, excitement, maybe even anxiety, that's where the power is. That's the moment of enthusiasm. That's when they're kissed by the muse. That's when they recognize their true spiritual nature, right? That's when they're getting, they're moving from that contemplation stage into the preparation stage. That's when we know change is imminent and that change is going to be glorious. Now, there's a problem with the preparation stage as we're preparing to make the change. We're preparing to make the move. We're preparing to flip that switch. Sometimes we get caught up in an ambivalence. Now, ambivalence means the passionate choice between two good options, perhaps so totally different from one another, and yet both of them really good. And it's hard for us to go beyond that. We're passionate about both options, both choices, so we get locked in ambivalence, locked in that struggle. And we get into what is called in learning theory, identity diffusion. We just simply can't seem to get past that stuckness in that preparation stage. But we have all the power we need, so we know with time it's going to happen. Maybe the anticipation will move to anxiety. Maybe the excitement will move into activity. And remember, with every new step comes a new perspective and a new opportunity for us in coaching. So we've decided in pre-contemplation stage, we have a vague sense something's wrong. In contemplation, we're stuck there, right? But we do at least know how to identify the problem, to give that person tea and sympathy, but don't help them out until they get to the place where the anticipation and excitement and maybe even anxiety is leading to activity. Because with activity comes a new session of coaching. Give them tea and sympathy until that point. Now they're in the preparation stage. The landmine here is ambivalence. Don't pick between two good choices as if there were only one that would ever work. Remember, the choice that will work is the one that you commit yourself to passionately, wholeheartedly. That's the choice that will succeed. There isn't only one right choice. There is the choice you make that you commit to, and it becomes right because of your commitment. And remember, what we're trying to do is escalate that level of commitment. So, from preparation to action, now we take action. And this is action, excuse me, that's in harmony with our SMART goals, right? It's in harmony with our sense of purpose, our sense of mission. It's on that A list, and we're moving down that 1,000-mile journey of life with just a step that's right underneath our feet. But every step, every moment of action sparks a new opportunity for coaching. Tell me what's important about that now. How does your vision change? How do you see things that are different? Tell me about your perspective now and how it was last week before we made that one single step. When you see an individual in action, normally what you see is, first and foremost, they take a step. The second thing that happens is everybody around them now has to adapt. And this is called family systems theory, that just basically says what the poet said once upon a time, no man is an island, right? He said, no man is an island. You might remember the poem. It says, ask not for whom the bell tolls, because it tolls for thee. He said, the death of every man diminishes me. Well, that sparked an entire new theory on group dynamics called family systems that tells us that, you know, that our family of creation, those are the people around us that we love and that love us, and a few old grouches, our family system is going to have to change if we change. And remember, change equals stress, stress equals change. Nobody likes stress. Nobody likes to change. We like consistency and predictability. Wow, how boring is that? So when we change, right, as we're approaching change, the landmine is ambivalent inside of us. When we change, everyone in our system has to change. And frankly, even if they don't like you, they're going to try and push you back into that exact same behavior that keeps them comfortable, because that's what they, how they want life to be. They want to be comfortable. They want life to be consistent, predictability, and frankly, they're not ready to change. Your change makes others have to change. It requires that they change, and they won't like that. So the landmine in action is that others are going to be pushing you back into exactly the same pre-contemplation stage where you were before. And that's a reality. It's the truth. Sometimes, now, here's where we're going to get harsh on the one hand and hopeful on the other hand. Sometimes who you want to become means that you're going to have to say goodbye to some of your childhood friends. Sometimes what you want so badly is going to mean that the things that you've grown up with and known and had in your past are no longer serving you. If they're no longer serving you in this new journey, in these new habits, and with this new action plan, you need to celebrate them, you need to love them, and you need to move forward. And that's just the way that works. So as we get to the maintenance stage, we have to recognize the big landmines here. In preparation, you're going to come up with 2, 3, 4, 10 different things that you want, that you really want, that you really, really, really want. You have to pick one, and you have to commit yourself and dedicate yourself wholeheartedly to that one thing. And remember, you may have 10 things on that A list. If you can't decide what's an A and what's B, then just remember any A is going to do, right? Any A will be successful as long as you commit yourself to that, right? Yeah, so ambivalence is the landmine in the preparation stage, and family dynamic is the landmine in the action stage. You're going to take action. Group dynamics says everybody in that family system is going to have to change because you change. Some are going to go along, others are going to drop off. That's the story of life. We celebrate the love that we had between each other. It doesn't mean we don't like them. It just means in this new stage of life, we're moving on, moving forward, and this is the new reality we live in. Otherwise, we're going to fall back. And guess what? There are lessons to learn in falling back. We'll go right back to that contemplation stage. Oh, I made a wrong decision. Oh, I made a wrong choice. Not necessarily, but it's okay for you to go back through that re-examination 4 or 5 times as you go through this. It's all right for you to pre-contemplate and say, you know, I have this vague sensation that this decision I made is wrong, but I don't know why. Recognize that's your friend. He's there to give you a little counsel. And go through the contemplation stage. Try to define it. Sit down with a friend. Sit down with a coach. Have some tea. Get a little sympathy. Go through that until you are unstuck. Then prepare once again and take action once again. And usually you'll find, after 4 or 5 times of this, you've got a very clear idea that what you chose in the first place really was the right path, and you really can commit yourself to it. And then, just like our pop star said, you gotta stay, right? Plan to stay. Maintenance then becomes the most important part of setting any goal and achieving any action or activity within coaching. You want to be successful in coaching? The first thing you have to think of is plan to stay. Now, when I'm giving counsel to someone, if I'm coaching them, among the earliest things I tell them is, or questions I ask them is, who has your life? Who has your life? Look at the people that you want to be like. Say, that's the person who has my life. And you do what they do, right? I used to say this, if you want to be successful, do what successful people do. If you want to be thin, do what thin people do. If you want to be rich, do what rich people do, right? Look at the people who have your life and say, that's who I want to be when I grow up. And it doesn't matter how old you are. You can still say that. It's still okay. Look at those people, right? And it doesn't hurt at all to find a mentor, to find someone who can help you to do those things consistently and predictably. They're going to allow you to have that greatest level of success. That's a wonderful technique in maintenance, right? Hang around the people who will reward and reinforce that behavior, because that's the only way you're ever going to make change permanent. And in the end, I did want to define mentor, by the way. A mentor was a guy in Homer's Odyssey and Iliad. Mentor was a guy who was a very, very wise guy. And when Odysseus went off on his Odyssey, he left his young son in the hands of mentor and told him, teach him what you know. And that became the definition of mentor. Teach this individual what you know. Nothing in the world wrong with gaining a mentor, especially if we ourselves have a deficiency in some knowledge. A coach is not a mentor. A coach is an individual who eventually makes himself invisible in the situation, assuming that you know all you need to take that first step. A coach is a voice of clarity. A mentor is a teacher. He's going to teach you what you need to know, what he knows. So when we get done with our stages of change, we've recognized what the landmines are, we understand how to do a SMART goal, then we go back and we ask ourselves that question. What's on that A-list, right? What do you want? What are your strengths? Recognize them. Ask people to help you to define them. What are your weaknesses? Define them. Embrace them. Ask the people you love and trust, the people who have your best interests at heart, not the ones trying to keep you where you are, but the ones supporting you to where you want to go and who you want to be. Ask them, who am I at my worst? What are my gremlins? What do you hear me always say that's negative, because that's a reflection of that inner council of critics that we have? And own it, right? Understand it. Don't embrace it, but also don't deny it, because there's power in something that we deny. I remember the title of a book, a little hint, I don't have any problem judging a book by its cover. I find that very easy. I may not be right, but I can certainly make the judgment. But I read the title of a book one time called Feelings Buried Alive Never Die. And I can tell you that if you try to deny that inner council of critics, that the power that it has over you, it will only gain more strength. So recognize it, embrace it, work with the people who have your best interests at heart, the people that matter to you and that you matter to them, and they'll help you to keep these things in their proper place. What do we want? What should we do to get there? We got SMART goals that can help us. What will we do? As leaders, we recognize that we're going to be recruiting other people to help us. Our SMART goals are timely, so by when will it be done, and by whom will it be done? What's our level of commitment? That takes us through Prochaska's changes again. Are we in pre-contemplation, contemplation? Are we ready for action or maintenance? Rate our overall level of commitment and escalate that commitment by choosing a single choice and focusing all of our energy on that one single choice. Remember, the one that will be the most successful is the one you'll commit yourself to wholeheartedly. Co-design accountability with your coach and with the people that you love. Assign your tasks, create your reward and penalty matrix. And when you take that first step, remember, that's your first step into a new world, a larger world. Now it's time for a new cycle of coaching. Well, it's always a pleasure to be here. This is the end of our call for this evening. Thank you all for your attention. These calls will all be posted on SamuelJBrandt, LLC.com, SamuelJBrandt, LLC.com. We have several calls. We're still working up a little gremlins in our system to get them all posted. Please consent to going there at some time. Take a look at the story of how we arrived where we are now. some of the important elements in the seven healers, and most especially how these coaching calls can help you prepare for your own career in coaching. We'll see you next week, same time, same station. Until then, have a good evening and have a good week. Bye-bye.